few modern scholars would dare. I am myself strongly inclined to believe this tradition, and I have sometimes speculated on the possibility of there being buried beneath one or more of the pyramids the remains of some prehistoric buildings that have survived the flood. There is more in the Hermetica that touches on this theme, and quite specifically a reminder of the books of Thoth, of their creation by Thoth Hermes himself, and of their purpose. For what he knew, he graved on stone, yet though he graved them onto stone, he hid them mostly, keeping sure silence, though in speech, that every younger generation of cosmic time might seek for them. Depositing his books, the wisdom god uttered the following words, admitting in the process his own perishability, and thus perhaps that he was no god, but a mortal human being. Ye holy books which have been written by my perishable hands, but have been anointed with the drug of imperishability, remain ye unseen and undiscovered by all men who shall go to and fro on the plains of this land, until the time when heaven, grown old, shall beget organisms worthy of you. Mead provides no explanation of this strange word organisms, sometimes also translated as instruments, but in his own edition of the Hermetica, Sir Walter Scott does. After long ages, he says, it means that there will be born men that are worthy to read the books of Hermes. Has that time come? Are we worthy at last to read those books of lost wisdom hidden away before the flood? And if so, what might they say? Part 8. Closure. Chapter 19. The Next Lost Civilization. More than 2,000 flood myths that have come down to us from the remote past are eerily consistent on many points, and on one in particular. The cataclysm was not a random accident, we are told. We brought it upon ourselves by our own behavior, our arrogance and our cruelty towards one another, our noise and strife, the wickedness of our hearts, angered the gods. We ceased to nurture spirit. We ceased to love and tend the earth, and no longer regarded the universe with reverent awe and wonder. Dazzled by our own success, we forgot how to carry our prosperity with moderation. So it was, Plato tells us, with the once generous and good citizens of Atlantis, who in former times possessed a certain greatness of mind, and treated the vagaries of fortune and one another with wisdom and forbearance, but who became swollen with overweening pride in their own achievements and fell into crass materialism, greed, and violence. To the perceptive eye, the depth of their degeneration was clear enough, but to those whose judgment of true happiness is defective, they seemed, in their pursuit of unbridled ambition and power, to be at the height of their fame and fortune. If ever a society could be said to meet all the mythological criteria of the next lost civilization, a society that ticks all the boxes, is it not obvious that it is our own? Our pollution and neglect of the majestic garden of the earth, our rape of its resources, our abuse of the oceans and the rainforests, our fear, hatred, and suspicion of one another, multiplied by 100 bitter regional and sectarian conflicts, our consistent track record of standing by and doing nothing while millions suffer, our ignorant, narrow-minded racism, our exclusivist religions, our forgetfulness that we are all brothers and sisters, our bellicose chauvinism, the dreadful cruelties that we indulge in the name of nation or faith or simple greed, our obsessive, competitive, ego-driven production and consumption of material goods, and the growing conviction of many, fueled by the triumphs of materialist science, that matter is all there is, that there is no such thing as spirit, that we are just accidents of chemistry and biology, all these things, and many more, in mythological terms at least, do not look good for us. Meanwhile, we have made ourselves the possessors of a technology so advanced that it seems almost like magic, even while we use it constantly in our daily lives. computer science, the internet, aviation, television, telecommunications, space exploration, genetic engineering, nuclear weapons, nanotechnology, transplant surgery, the list goes on and on. Yet very few of us are able to understand how more than a tiny fraction of it works, and as it proliferates, the human spirit withers, and we engage in all manner of reckless crimes, wars and robberies and frauds, and all things hostile to the nature of the soul. Suppose, for a moment, that a cataclysm besets us, a cataclysm so vast that our complex, networked, highly specialized technological civilization collapses utterly beyond any hope of redemption. If such a scenario were to unfold, it is likely that the meekest and most marginalized of the peoples who inhabit our world today, the hunter-gatherers of the Amazon jungle and the Kalahari Desert, for example, who are used to making do with very little, and whose survival skills are exemplary, would be the very ones most likely to make it through and therefore carry on the story of humanity in post-cataclysmic times. How would their descendants remember us 1,000 or 10,000 years from now? How, for example, might something that we regard as routine, like our ability to receive 24-hour rolling television news and hear sound and view images from all parts of the world and even from outer space, be recollected in myth and tradition? Might it not be said wonderingly of us, as it was of the forefathers recalled in the Popol Vuh, the sacred book of the ancient K'iche Maya? They were endowed with intelligence. They saw, and instantly they could see far. They succeeded in seeing, they succeeded in knowing, all that there is in the world. When they looked, instantly they saw all around them. And they contemplated in turn the arch of heaven and the round face of the earth. The things hidden in the distance, they saw all, without first having to move. At once they saw the world, and so too, from where they were, they saw it. Great was their wisdom. Their sight reached to the forests, the lakes, the seas, the mountains, and the valleys. Yet in common with so many other memories that seem to hark back to an advanced lost civilization of prehistoric antiquity, we learn that in due course the forefathers became arrogant and proud and overstepped their bounds, so that the gods asked, "Must they perchance be the equals of ourselves, their makers? Let us check a little their desires, because it is not well what we see." Punishment swiftly followed. The heart of heaven blew mist into their eyes, which clouded their sight as when a mirror is breathed on. Their eyes were covered, and they could see only what was close. Only that was clear to them. In this way, all the wisdom and all the knowledge of the forefathers were destroyed. It is interesting to note the mechanisms used by the gods to keep our ancestors in their place, as described in the Popol Vuh. A flood was brought about by the heart of heaven. A heavy resin fell from the sky. The face of the earth was darkened, and a black rain began to fall, by day and by night. The faces of the sun and the moon were covered. There was much hail, black rain and mist, and indescribable cold. All these phenomena very accurately reflect the complex nature of the cataclysm that afflicted the Earth 12,800 years ago at the beginning of the Younger Dryas Cold Epoch, when, as we saw from the mass of evidence presented in Part 2, many scientists are now certain that the Earth was struck by several large fragments of a disintegrating giant comet. It is my opinion, indeed it's the reason I've written this book, that we need to pay attention to such accounts and the universal details that unite them, whether they come down to us from Mexico, from Peru, from Easter Island, from Mesopotamia, from ancient Egypt, from ancient Canaan, or from Turkey. It's intriguing, for example, against the background of flood and cataclysm it describes, that the Popol Vuh makes mention of fishmen, exactly like the Apkalu sages of Mesopotamia, who had the whole body of a fish, but underneath and attached to the head of the fish there was another head, human, and joined to the tail of the fish, feet like those of a man. Exactly like the Apkalu too, these fishmen reported in the traditions of the ancient Maya possessed magical powers and worked many miracles. It is perhaps not surprising, therefore, that Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, the civilization bringer who appears in the Popol Vuh under the name of Gucumatz, should be represented, as we saw in Chapter 1, by an ancient image from La Venta on the Gulf of Mexico, in which he holds the exact same sort of bag or bucket that the Apkalu hold in the Mesopotamian reliefs, and that is also figured on Pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey. La Venta was one of the centers of the mysterious early civilization of the Olmecs, who left behind sculptures of bearded men with features that do not look at all like those of Native Americans, but resemble the bearded figures shown in the Mesopotamian Apkalu reliefs and in the statues of Contiki Viracocha at Tiwanaku in Bolivia, again hinting at universal symbolism associated with a group of individuals who sought to disseminate the gifts of civilization all around the world. Moreover, it is widely recognized that the extraordinary astronomical science for which the Maya are famed was part of a wider body of advanced knowledge that had been passed down to them by the Olmecs, and that the Mayan calendar itself is probably best understood as one of these Olmec legacies. As we saw in Chapter 15, a great cycle of the Mayan calendar came to an end on the 21st of December 2012. It is an end date that was calculated to mark the once-in-26,000-year conjunction of the winter solstice sun and the center of the Milky Way galaxy, a conjunction that is itself, because of the diameter of the sun and the limitations of naked-eye astronomy, not so much a precise moment in time as a window 80 years wide spanning the period 1960 to 2040. We saw, too, how Pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe uses solar and constellation symbolism to depict the exact same window through which, as any astronomical software program will confirm, the winter solstice sun is still transiting today. My intuition is that these devices, both the Mayan calendar and the Göbekli Tepe pillar, are an attempt, using the precessional code, to send a message to the future. I see the lineaments of that message also in the huge astronomical geoglyph formed by the pyramids and the Great Sphinx of Giza. Using the same code and their relationship to the constellations of Orion and Leo, these monuments draw our attention to the epoch of the Younger Dryas between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago, and through the symbolism of the return of the phoenix to the epoch that falls half a precessional cycle later, that is, once again, our own epoch. The targeting here is not so precise as that afforded by the Göbekli Tepe pillar and the Mayan calendar, but then neither is the science by which the impacts that set off the Younger Dryas are dated to 12,800 years ago. The resolution of the carbon-14 evidence upon which scientists base this chronology means that a tolerance of plus or minus 150 years must be allowed. In other words, the Younger Dryas comet, let us for convenience refer to it as the Phoenix, could have struck the Earth as late as 12,650 years ago, in other words, in 10,635 BC, since I'm writing in AD 2015, or as early as 12,950 years ago, in other words, in 10,935 BC. Bearing in mind that half a precessional cycle is 12,960 years, or 12,954 years in the peculiarly exact calculations of the return of the Phoenix reported by Solinus, we are therefore being invited to consider a period that begins in just 10 years from the time of writing, in other words around AD 2025, and that cannot be considered to have passed safely until AD 2325, that is, until the full 12,960 years have elapsed after the latest possible date for the Phoenix impacts. The Mayan calendar and Pillar 43 at Göbekli Tepe, however, refine the calculation, as we've seen. If I understand the message correctly, we're in the danger zone now, and will be until 2040. I'm reminded of the Ojibwa tradition cited in Chapter 3. The star with the long, wide tail is going to destroy the world someday when it comes low again. That's the comet called Long-Tailed Heavenly Climbing Star. It came down here once, thousands of years ago, just like the sun. It had radiation and burning heat in its tail. The comet burnt everything to the ground. There wasn't a thing left. Indian people were here before that happened, living on the earth. But things were wrong. A lot of people had abandoned the spiritual path. The Holy Spirit warned them a long time before the comet came. Medicine men told everyone to prepare. Things were wrong with nature on the earth. Then that comet went through here. It had a long, wide tail, and it burnt up everything. It flew so low, the tail scorched the earth. The comet made a different world. After that, survival was hard work. The weather was colder than before. Does it sound like scaremongering to suggest that the comet remembered in this and in so many other myths and traditions from all parts of the globe might be about to stage its great return? Am I reading too much into recondite ancient monuments and calendars and into the fact that everywhere, universally, across all cultures, comets have always been regarded with fear and loathing and as omens of impending doom and destruction? I'm not sure what the right answer to these questions is. From a personal point of view, as a loving father and grandfather, I would greatly prefer it if there was no such danger. Yet at the same time, if there is danger, we would be foolish to bury our heads in the sand and pretend that there's nothing to worry about and no action we need to take. I'm therefore obliged to point out that the most recent science on this subject is in complete agreement with ancient wisdom. There is danger. The House of History is built on sand. We are in the midst of a profound paradigm shift regarding how we view the evolution of human civilization. As noted at the end of Chapter 5, archaeologists have been in the habit of regarding cosmic impacts, supposedly only occurring at multi-million-year intervals, as largely irrelevant to the 200,000-year story of anatomically modern humans. When we believe that the last big impact had been the dinosaur-killing asteroid of 65 million years ago, there was obviously little point in trying to relate cosmic accidents on such an almost unimaginable scale in any way to the much shorter time frame of history. But the nightmare scenario raised by the group of scientists behind the Younger Dryas impact hypothesis, and supported by the mass of compelling evidence reviewed in Part 2, namely that a huge, earth-shaking, extinction-level event occurred just 12,800 years ago in our historical backyard, changes everything. First and foremost, it means that the historical timeline now taught as fact in all our schools and institutions of higher learning, the slow, painful steps from Paleolithic to Neolithic, the development of agriculture, the rise of the first cities, and so on and so forth, in short, all the conclusions archaeology has come to about the origins of civilization rest on false foundations. For by what word, other than false, can the underpinnings of the existing historical paradigm be described when we now know that they were put in place without taking into account the single biggest cataclysm to hit the Earth since the extinction of the dinosaurs? This cataclysm, moreover, unfolded in a very specific and very recent period, the Younger Dryas between 12,800 and 11,600 years ago, and was immediately followed by the first signs of the emergence of civilization at Göbekli Tepe in Turkey, and soon afterwards at many other points around the globe. To recognize, as archaeologists now do, that these early experiments in civilized living all took place right after the Younger Dryas punctuation mark, yet to take no account of the massive worldwide trauma and destruction unleashed by the cosmic impacts that caused the Younger Dryas, is a real lapse of scholarship. What is worse, however, is the parallel failure to devote even a moment's consideration to the possibility that crucial chapters of the human story, perhaps even a great civilization of prehistoric antiquity, might have been erased from the historical record by those impacts and by the floods, the black bituminous rain, the time of darkness, and the indescribable cold that followed. If our own civilization were to pass through a comparable cascade of giant impacts, would we survive? All the indications are that we would not. And this is why, in my view, the